Hey everyone, I just wanted to briefly say that Blaine and I are really upset and bummed, as a lot of people in this world are, by the loss of George Romero. The man was a visionary, a prophet, pretty much one of the most important people to ever be involved in the horror film genre. And, of course, that's a genre very near and dear to both of our hearts. So, I hope you enjoy this episode that is unrelated to Romero, and was recorded before we found out about Romero's passing a couple weeks ago. We recorded this episode. So, rest in peace to Romero, and our thoughts and prayers with his family and friends. And also to other great acting folks, great actors that recently passed. John Hurd, who most of you probably, at least myself as well, think of him as Mr. McAllister in Home Alone. But of course, Chud and several other genre films that he was involved with. And then, of course, we're also saddened to hear about Martin Landau, another great actor who did some great genre work. And outside of the genre, just a really tragic death of a young Chester Bennington. And I'm not a Linkin Park fan, but got to hear about a younger musician, a guy who's just a little bit older than myself, taking his own life is just depressing as all hell. Thankfully, this is a pretty uplifting episode, so hopefully you can enjoy hearing Bickert and my co-host ramble on like a bunch of old friends, because that's what they are. And you can also enjoy my occasional interjection, which I attempted to hold my own, but these guys, they know a lot more than I about this exploitation world. So I kind of took a back seat in a lot of ways. Next episode, we'll be talking to Stephen Biro from Unearthed Films, getting way more into some of the faith stuff that really interests us, but in a really interesting and dark way, because if you're not familiar with Unearthed and with Biro, some of the darker and more fucked up films in the recent past have come through them and through him. So it'll be really interesting to get to know a little bit more about a man of faith who is really drawn to the dark side of film and the gore and the guts and the really just depraved stuff, and really kind of where that all melts, where that all goes together. So I hope you enjoyed the intro track as a little nod to our recently deceased hero. And I also hope you enjoy some of the other music and other stuff that I throw into this episode, kicking us off with The Young Werewolves, a band from the Philadelphia area who I believe is now defunct, but I couldn't not play them when I had a werewolf movie, or kind of sort of a werewolf movie, but we'll talk about that. So, again, enjoy the episode, and I will see you on the flip-flop, or whatever the hell kids are saying these days.
Drive downtown, the kids are out. Can't you hear them? Hey, welcome back everyone to episode 5 of Grindhouse Messiah with me, Blaine McLaren, and my wonderful co-hosts.
Justin Harlan. I don't know about wonderful co-hosts, but I am your co-host.
Co-host nonetheless, but this week we are back with another fabulous guest here. We've got a gentleman who's got an incredible encyclopedic knowledge of all film in general, but mainly in exploitation, B-movie garbage, a great writer and director in his own right, and personal friend, James Anthony Bicker, director of Dear God No, Dumpster Baby, and most recently, Frankenstein Created Bikers. How's it going, Jimmy?
Hey, man. How you doing, Blaine? Hi, Justin.
Hey, nice to meet you, Jimmy. I appreciate you coming on the show with us, and I just got a chance to see Frankenstein Created Bikers. I'm looking forward to talking about that film. And as a little preview to my thoughts on these three films, the two that we are talking about and yours, I only liked one of them, but I'll just leave it at that, and we'll find out if yours is the one.
Well, Jimmy, man, it's great. It's great having you on this episode. I know these are a few movies that you and I have chatted about in just personal text messages and everything back and forth. More specifically, Sweet Sugar. So we're gonna kind of dive right into these movies, and we'll start on you going into Sweet Sugar, man. I know this is something that you've really been wanting to see come out on a decent copy, and basically, we're looking at a movie starring Phyllis Davis, the lovely, lovely Phyllis Davis of Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. And it's about a prostitute named Sugar, I guess presumably a prostitute. She gets set up by a corrupt politician. She's convinced that she's not getting out of her case. It ends up going to apparently the most batshit plantation in all of our undisclosed South American Caribbean location, where she ends up having to deal with chain gang run-ins, as well as crazy voodoo and
of course Dr. John.
Dr. John, man.
Meet Sugar. She's beautiful, in chains, and she's busting out, shackled to the steamy cane fields of a tropical inferno. They're women. They're warm. They're wildcats.
Hey, black gal, you gonna get Mojo some of your stuff?
I don't mess around with bush bunnies.
Hung up, strung out. The searing sting of the whip burned a brand of hate into her heart. Their world, a plantation. Their battleground, a tropical inferno. She can cut any man down to size.
Listen to me! We can take this place! Let's go!
Warm hands, cold trigger, blazing death. An epidemic of machine gun madness. 38 caliber kittens spitting death as they claw their way to freedom. Nothing can hold her. Not chains, not bars or men. Sweet Sugar.
When I was a kid, I loved it after Phyllis Davis.
Yeah, Vegas.
And she was so hot on the Match Game. So then I came across the trailer for Sweet Sugar on a Full Moon compilation called The Best of Sex and Violence that was hosted by John Carradine and had like lots of great trailers that probably started me just like seeking out exploitation films that I hadn't caught at the drive-in as a kid. And there's just so many good ones on there, like all the Dolomite movies and a lot of women in prison films, and Twilight People. And from there I ended up tracking down a VHS that just had God awful audio quality. And then that same tape got repackaged with crappy audio into like Hellfire on ice or something like that. And then there was Captive Women 3, She Girls in Chains. And I bought them all, and they all had shitty audio.
like those releases tend to be.
Yeah, I was stoked to see, you know, this beautiful copy that Vinegar Syndrome released.
Oh, yeah, no,
Vinegar Syndrome. But I got to tell you something. I've got, there was a DVD that was released by a company called Iguana, probably like early 2000s. And it had some bonus footage on there that's not on the Vinegar Syndrome release. And I'll have to show you this stuff, Blaine, because what it is the DP kept the camera rolling the entire time Phyllis Davis was doing her shower scene takes.
Oh.
Like, they did not turn off the camera. And, I mean, there is so much boobage of her extra stuff. It's great.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that's kind of one of my only complaints in the whole movie is not enough. I want more Phyllis Davis there. I wonder why that got left off. There must have been a reason for that, because I couldn't see the dudes over at Vinegar Syndrome leaving that off unless it was a legal reason.
Yeah. I mean, this was like cutting room floor stuff. It was great.
Oh, yeah. I mean... That's the definition to me as of a special feature. Oh yeah, and like I said, this movie was always kind of off my radar. I don't know. I've been collecting, you know, garbage compilations, you know, of B flicks and sexploitation movies for a long time now, and I don't know how this movie stayed off my radar, but it did. And like I said, I was expecting something completely different than what I got. And for me, like, Phyllis Davis being the star of the movie makes a huge difference, because she does such a good job as just kind of this bitchy, you know, sarcastic heroine. And I mean, so every situation she gets in, I can buy it, even though it's fucking ridiculous, but I love it.
Yeah.
I love her interactions.
If I may offer a counterpoint, I don't think it's fucking ridiculous enough.
What about the cats on LSD or whatever the hell they were on?
I guess that's fair. That is fair. I mean, no, there's some really insane stuff in it. I'm not going to pretend there's not. But I found myself wanting more from it. And I don't know, maybe Blaine oversold it for me. I'm not really sure. But yeah. I hadn't seen it yet until yesterday, the day before, when I watched it. And, you know, I really I did enjoy it, but not – that's probably not true. I didn't really enjoy it. I know.
So good.
I didn't hate it. I didn't hate it. I know. So, but what I'll say is that I did think it was I thought it was interesting – as far as like how it was written, I thought the plot was pretty batshit crazy, and I appreciate all that. I definitely appreciate all that.
Did write more. I mean, he did the student nurses and the big dollhouse, and student nurses pretty batshit crazy.
Hmm. Oh yeah,
I think
to me, like Terminal Island is one of the closest films for me with this movie. That it really reminds me of, you know, Terminal Island and those Don Marshall flicks.
Yeah, well, Stephanie Rothman was like co-producer on that and Sweet Sugar too.
Oh, and okay.
She wrote and directed like a ton of, well, The Student Nurses and The Velvet Vampire, Working Girls. It's got a Cassandra Peterson naked in it.
Right. Yeah, and also Track of the Vampire, right?
I know she did Bloodbath with Jack Hill.
I think Track of the Vampire. I think that was Jack Hill and Stephanie Rothman, but I could be wrong. I'm going off the dome on that.
You might be right. She wrote a film. It was directed by Barbara Peters, who did Humanoids from the Deep.
Right.
With Dick Miller called Star Hops. And that's been one that's like my holy grail. I have it, but it, from a VHS, but it's cut. And you can tell, and they cut right before every sex scene's about to happen. You could tell it had sex scenes.
Right. Like,
sex scenes. But the U.S. VHS release of it's cut to shit.
Oh, shit, man. Yeah.
Hopefully Vinegar Syndrome digs that one up.
And I imagine they are. I mean, pretty much anything that we've mentioned that we want to see on Blu-ray, they've been doing a hell of a job lately of tracking it down and putting it out. So that's got to be somewhere on their docket, especially with the amount of films that they're releasing these days.
Yeah, and they got Terminal Island streaming, and I wish they would release it too. I'm not part of their streaming service, so. I'd always heard there's a Canadian cut that has a little more nudity, because the cut I've always seen didn't have hardly anything. Like, Phil Davis doesn't get naked.
Right. If they've got it on exploitation TV, it's got a lot of nudity. I swear to God, every movie on that is like just it's amazingly awesome. It's just all porn, basically. I watched some movie. I was telling Blade, I just did the I did the free trial of it. I intend to resubscribe at some point once I have a little extra money. But I did the free trial, and I remember putting on several movies, being like, "Oh, this is awesome! This one says it's a kung fu movie," and there was like one fight in the whole movie. The rest of it was just sex, and I was like, "Oh, okay, yeah, all right."
You're watching kung fu zombies, right?
I think that was the one. That sounds
right. Kung Fu Zombies has got very little kung fu, and even less zombies in it. It's just mainly
no kung fu from beyond the grave.
Which, speaking of, like, you and I always keep talking about Vinegar Syndrome. When are they going to start releasing like Gregory Dark films and kind of that whole era of real experimental porno movies?
Yeah, that would be cool. Especially all the I forget the guy's name, but he went under like Rinse Dream and several other ones that made Night Dreams and Cafe Flesh. Those films are so damn good.
Yeah, Steven Seyedian? I believe that's his name.
Yeah.
Cafe Flesh and Night Dreams are actual classics, in my opinion. Like, those need real releases as well as Water Power.
Yeah, that would be great, man. I love Water Power.
I need those enemas in HD. I need those enema pixels.
Yeah, and just that laughter, that maniacal laughter. Watching Jake Gillis, like, you know, that whole movie, I'm just fascinated by it because of the guy Michael Canyon.
Right.
Do you know about this?
No.
All right, so it's loosely based on this guy named Michael Canyon, who Frank Zappa wrote a song about called the Illinois Enema Bandit.
Right.
And he was robbing banks, had like a tri-state bank robbing spree, but he would tie up the cashiers and give them an enema.
That is bizarre.
It is. And there's there's like a jazz song about him, and he got paroled like in the 90s, but I don't know whatever happened to him. Now, he would be a great guest.
Oh, man. If I can track down that guy, I'm sure he's probably working at some shitty car lot somewhere. I've got to find that guy and have him on the show. He probably lives
down in Atlanta. That's where y'all all
live. I wonder if he just walks around every day, you know, and you'll see a nice ass and just be like, oh, man. Oh, I can't do it. I can't do it. I can't go back in. I mean, his whole life's turmoil.
All I gotta do every day is not.
That sounds to me like a movie that you need to make. That sounds like a movie maybe, to
maybe he found a nice lady that just likes enemas.
Yeah, because I imagine a guy like that would get some pretty great letters in jail. He probably came out
set up after that.
Yeah, he just showed up and he's just giving enemas left and right. He's even bored with them at this point.
So back to Sweet Sugar.
Oh yeah, we were talking about a movie.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. I think I'm just done with enemas for a little while. I acted like I didn't like the movie at all. Like I did enjoy the movie for the most part. I just like I said, I wanted more, and I don't know why. Because when I look at the description of the movie, when I think of all the things in the movie, I don't really know how I wanted more. But it's definitely a really interesting film. And the premise is really, really, really batshit crazy.
Can you believe that they fed a mojo?
I don't know, man. Like that whole character is like bizarre. When an inmate who's out to work on the fields and whatever, that's actually their spiritual leader, but whatever his freaking religion was, I'm not exactly sure.
Hoodoo. Kind of racist 70s hoodoo.
Yeah. Oh, Lord. Yep. Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah, and you know who that was, right? That was Timothy Brown.
Yeah, he played Spear Chucker Jones in the first season of MASH.
Right. Oh, yeah. He was a star. One of the stars of Nashville, right? With the Altman flick.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was one of those guys that definitely blew up, as he got through. Like, I mean, I remember him from the movies. I remember him from mainly his Dynamite Brothers and then Nashville. Because I've always had kind of a sweet spot for Robert Altman, especially during that kind of late 70s, early 80s.
Definitely.
Yeah, no,
man. I did not even put together that's Timothy Brown as in Timmy Brown from the fucking Eagles. I've been 8 year back for the Eagles.
You're from Philadelphia, man. How are you going to miss that?
You already know I'm a transplant. I'm from fucking dirty Jersey. Give me a break.
but yeah, so, I mean, I don't know what else you're asking for with it, but, I mean, to me, it's one of those. It's another one of those movies, though. There, it's moments of payoff, and I think mm-hmm. that rings true with a lot of these kinds of films, where it could be a crazy scenario, a lot of things happen. We talked about cats on LSD being just tossed into a bamboo.
That was bizarre and amazing. Yeah, I'll give you that.
But it's the moments in these kind of flicks where there's a lot of downtime. There's a lot of time they're just padding that 90-minute runtime, trying to keep it above about 80 minutes or so and just padding it. But it's those great moments. I think Sweet Sugar is a great example of hitting those moments, where every 15 minutes, something weird's just going to happen. And that last action set piece, man, that's fucking rad. A lot of good explosions, mm-hmm. quite a bit of mayhem.
I'm excited to rewatch it at some point, to try to tamper my expectations and maybe give it a clearer look at it, and I'll probably be like, what the fuck was I thinking? This movie is ridiculous. So I'm hopeful that this is actually going to become one that I like more and more as time goes on. I'm actually pretty sure that's going to be the case. So
absolutely. I love when you pad out a movie with two lesbians frolicking in a waterfall.
Yeah, that's the best kind of padding. At least you're not driving in a car like most of these movies where they just drive for 25 minutes. At least you got a 17-year-old lesbian, frolicking and playing, and I'm never going to complain.
Yeah.
I think that it was funny that the 17-year-old character looked like she was like easily mid-range of the actresses as far as age. I was like, there's a lot of other girls here that look a lot younger than you. But, that's normal.
Hey, she's blonde.
She was the blonde one. She's... The blonde one is the 17-year-old.
No matter what, the blonde one in these movies are always going to be like the farm girl who somehow ended up in South America. Which Jimmy, Jimmy, I got to ask you, if you had to guess, where is this taking place?
Oh, just some Banana Republic. That's all that matters.
I know. I was just curious because it is the strangest makeshift of kind of where it lines up and everything. It's just like, we're here. It's the Caribbean. It's South America. It's somewhere.
Yeah, it's some jungle hellhole.
Right.
And I love when they set the plantation on fire and they're running back and forth in front of the same fire over and over again.
I thought it was just taking place at Trump's house. But I just assume that's the kind of shit that goes on back in his backyard. But, you know, I don't know.
Oh, man. If that's true, 4 more years, man. But
the only time you'll hear that endorsement on this podcast is when we're talking about this. Oh, Lord.
The one who speaks for them, let them eat their bread and drink their wine, and in the night benign, sleep.
Don't miss the most unusual and exciting horror motorcycle film yet made.
I come to offer you youth and fresh, fresh blood.
Hey, we all know how we're going to die, baby. We're going to crash and burn.
Werewolves on Wheels, starring Steve Oliver and Severn Darden. The story of a motorcycle gang who ride into a new kind of hell. They ride wild, play hard, and fight brutal.
I write your unholy name thrice in blood.
By of Satan, you are one with them. By of Satan, you are one with them. By of Satan.
Werewolves on Wheels, the most eerie, the most chilling, the most terrifying motorcycle horror film ever made. Their survival was the torch, as one by one they became terrifying, bloodthirsty werewolves on wheels. Don't miss the first horror motorcycle film ever made, Werewolves on Wheels. Rated R.
Hey, Justin, why don't you bring us into Werewolves on Wheels, since this is your favorite of the three?
I'll fucking try. All right, so at least the first movie we just talked about is a movie. As far as I'm concerned, I'm not really sure the next one is. Especially since even Blaine, who liked the movie, and I told him I was going to use his words against him, when I texted him, oh man, I don't like this movie at all, he was like, well, I'm not sure it's really a movie, but I like it. And so that said, I'll give you the little brief for the listeners with the plot summary, and then I'll go back to lambasting it. A group of bikers moves across the desert. I'm going straight out of Wikipedia for a minute here. They come across an old church that a satanic cult has taken over. The cultists give them drug food, and the bikers soon fall asleep. And rather than read the rest of this, I'm not really sure exactly what happens other than bikers being bikers for the rest of the movie. Just, you know, fucking around, doing crazy shit. And there's a werewolf in the movie for like 20 seconds or something. But yeah, I was actually hoping to see like more werewolves and more stuff. But, you know, what was I thinking with the title Werewolves on Wheels? But hey, ultimately, this was by far of these three films the one I like to leave.
Well, he also, the director, worked on Naked Angels, which, have you ever seen that one?
I have not.
It is so dull, and you would think naked biker chicks in the desert would be semi-exciting, but it's like paint dry. But I really like Werewolves on Wheels just for the bizarre tone, and I just like the way it starts off with that montage of these characters going down the road, and they're like simulating, you know, sucking a dick and flipping each other off, and you know, it's just got that great score and that whole sequence with the girl.
I do like the music.
Yeah, I could sit there and drink beer and watch that girl dance with that snake, like, for hours. Just put it on a loop.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm more in Jimmy's camp on this one. Like, I like the tone of the flick more than I like the movie itself. I mean, what's going on? It's just a mishmash of a bunch of stuff that was popular at the time, but I love all the B-roll throughout the movie of just bikers being bikers. And that opening scene where they chase down the dude in the pickup truck and they show up to that bar. And, I mean, to me, it's a great introduction. I mean, they don't do a lot with the characters after that, but you know immediately that these are real bikers, which, I mean, they did use real bikers for the film, and it's just goofy nonsense, and it seems like a bunch of guys just hanging out. mean, and every time those musical cues hit, I mean, I'm just on board, just hanging out, watching them shoot, because I don't think the movie gets credit on how those actual, like, B-roll parts are shot. I mean, those are great views of you know, all the bikes you get, all that, because...
I'm talking
to you, Jimmy, a lot of these biker movies, there's not a lot of motorcycles all the time. This one has way more
motorcycles.
That's because they
break down.
Yeah.
That's what I think it was Roger Corman said, you got to get some, like, 50 bikes, and then you'll probably have 10 of them running at one time.
I believe I remember Jet Bryant, the star of your films, say that you guys were, by the end of your film, you were calling it Frankenstein created walkers, just because the amount of problems of trying to get motorcycles on the road.
Yeah, me and John Collins both broke down up in the mountains while we were filming, and I just waved the camera truck on. I was like, those other bikes are running, just keep filming.
Oh yeah. And there's no shortage in Werewolves on Wheels, which is a rarity. Yeah, but I mean, it's a pretty breezy film. I mean, it's like 80 minutes long. You kind of fly through it. Like you said, you get a great, you know, you get a great little sexy nude dance from the main actress there. You get the goofy, you know, Satanist showing up. And the end of that movie, which I don't care, I'm going to spoil a 45-year-old movie here. When they show up after the little bit of werewolf that we got to see in the dark, and they just show up and they've joined the cult. I love how bad the ending. It was just like, we're ending the movie now, you know.
Yeah, that's good. I've got the one sheet on my wall. I love that movie so much. Yeah, but you know, if you have an extended sequence of a lady dancing naked with a snake, I'm just gonna be all about it. That's probably the two films I will watch most in my backyard are probably Mondo Topless and Orgy of the Dead.
Orgy of the Dead, I love that movie mainly for how bored the girls look after you're about 3 or 4 minutes into the dance.
I'm just so glad they captured them, because those were like the top circuit go-go girls at that time.
Right. Yeah, and it's definitely one of those movies where it's an ultimate party movie.
Both of those, and man, I wish they were released on scope, because that would just be a revelation.
Oh, absolutely. And speaking of Vinegar Syndrome earlier, I remember briefly hearing them talk about releasing that. I think that's one of those movies that they've kind of got in the barrel there, you know, for when it's time to roll it out. And that
I hope so. Man, I love Vinegar Syndrome. They're making me so happy.
Me too. Every single month they announce something that I want to see. And real quick, hey, those are the plugs, because we've got those guys sponsoring the podcast now. So
I wasn't even aware of that.
I know. We're plugging them.
We just begged and begged, like, well. All you have to do is send us movies and you're our sponsor. And they're like, we can do that. Like,
so, Justin, when you actually finally...
Maybe Pabst Blue Ribbon will do that, too.
Right, well, I'm, I, I'm a beer nerd, but if I'm going to drink crappy beer, I like it to be real crappy. So I'm all about PBR then.
Ooh. Well, you could always go for Dogfish Head.
Yeah.
I don't know. They might be a little bit above our level. I'm not really sure what they're into, but they are weirdos, so they might like this kind of stuff too.
Yeah.
What were you going to say, Blaine?
I was going to say, Justin, I know you brought up earlier about the werewolf. So what did you think when you finally did get to see a werewolf on wheels? Did it satiate it at least a little bit for you?
Fuck no. Come on, man. That was weak shit. In fact, that was one of the weakest parts of this film.
I thought he looked kind of like Paul Nashy on a motorcycle.
Yeah, he did. It looked like... He did. That's a good call.
That actually is a pretty damn good call. I'll say that. Yeah, he did. But I would see. On the other hand, I'd love to see a movie that's just Paul Nashy as a werewolf on a motorcycle for a fucking hour and a half, like that, with a bunch of naked chicks dancing with whatever kind of animals, you know, snakes and lizards and whatever. That's that movie right there. It doesn't even need dialogue. I'm in.
I'm sure one of these days Mondo Macabro will find that Paul Nashy movie and release it. Because that guy, I mean, he's got every single time I think that I've seen every Paul Nashy film, Mondo Macabro releases three or four more, and they're basically the same.
Yeah, they haven't released the one where he's like in feudal Japan.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man.
That's a combination that should be happening more these days. Just
Paul Nashy and feudal Japan?
Yeah.
Okay. That's that would be better than fucking Tom Cruise in Feudal Japan, right? I mean...
Oh, yeah, much better.
Oh, man.
Well, great. Well,
so,
go ahead,
man. I was just going to say that this movie was... And it wasn't quite as boring. I'm not going to say it's as bad as, but it reminded me a lot of how I feel about Psychomania, which is a movie that I read the description and I'm like, shit, this is going to be awesome. And then I watch it and I'm like, okay.
I guess
it's fine.
Like,
now, this one, on the other hand, at least the bikers acted like bikers, not like a bunch of stuffy fucking Englishmen who pretended to be bikers. So, now that I just offended anybody from England, sorry, English, there's like three of you.
Yeah. Besides the Psychomania, I don't care.
They are creatures of darkness, waiting for their moment to strike, waiting to prey on the innocent, and no power on earth can stop them. They're bad. They're beautiful. They're
eight broads on the rag.
For the love of men. For the love of animals.
Yo, the dog.
For the love of God, does anyone know how to stop them?
Bring back the dead.
All these people are dead.
They're dead.
They're going to eat you, bitch.
Now, it's the Queens of Ghoul.
Nobody runs me out of town.
Against the zombie ghoul.
That's my husband, you think?
Your husband's dead.
In a war that's got everyone losing their head.
Got no respect for property. What kind of trash are you?
Just another action comedy horror biker zombie movie.
Blow me.
But wrapping this up, I mean, it kind of transition. We talked a little about what it was like, you know, getting, you know, trying to put together a biker flick. And since we have the only person that's made biker flicks over the past few years here on the podcast, Jimmy, tell us a little bit about, you know, putting together, you know, Dear God No, when Frankenstein created bikers, and kind of some of the films that really, you know, inspired that, you know, with films like Werewolves on Wheels and things of that ilk. Tell us a little bit more about what made you want to make a biker flick that kind of call back to these films of yesteryear.
Well, it all started, well, I guess I was just watching the entire biker cycle. And I really fell in love with Northville Cemetery Massacre.
Yes, sir.
And Wild Angels has always been my favorite. But we were watching, I mean, I've got a drive-in in my backyard. So there was a period there where I was just watching everything. Hell's Chosen Few, you know, anything I could find. And we were watching, oh, God. The Rebel Rousers, I think it was the one with Dennis Hopper is the star of it. No, the Glory Stompers. That's what I think. I think that's it. And he had just died, and we were watching it, me and a bunch of just effects artists, and we had eaten a bunch of mushrooms. I just was like, man, we need to make a biker movie. And let's do it for Dennis.
Right.
And then I was, you know, just like, whoa, you know, in all this biker cycle, you know, it was always like the bikers get out of hand, but other than like maybe Stone a little bit, they're never really portrayed as just complete, utter psychotic scumbags.
Right.
And I just wanted to do that. You know, I was like, what if, you know, instead of one serial killer, you've got five. And then, you know, I was, you know, right around that time, I had seen, Night of the Demon, that Bigfoot movie.
Yeah.
And then I remember there's a movie with John Carradine called Bigfoot, where Bigfoot's holding up a motorcycle on the one sheet poster. And the movie's terrible, and it, you know, it just never delivers that image. And I saw it when I was a kid at the drive-in. And so I was like, fuck yeah, man, I'm going to make a Bigfoot that rips people's heads off. I'm gonna stick him in this bike.
And with kind of delivering on all those unfulfilled promises, was that kind of part of what, you know, because when you watch a lot of these kind of movies, there's always big promises that rarely pay off. Like, you kind of got to adjust your expectations. Well, I always describe Frankenstein Created Bikers as well as Dear God No are both like, if you took all those kind of lost promises from that era of filmmaking, that drive-in era, and put all those failed promises into one flick, that's kind of what you get. I mean, was that kind of something that you thought about?
Yeah, because when I was a kid, both my parents were going to college at a University of Tennessee when I was little, and they were both teaching in order to get their degrees paid for, so they didn't get to spend much time with each other. So we'd always go to the drive-in, and they'd stick me in the front seat. And then I'd pretend to be asleep, and then I'd watch, you know, some ridiculous shit. Like, I remember seeing Tombs of the Blind Dead, you know, right, as like six-year-old. And like the trailers, I'd always watch those. And then I, you know, later on, I started sneaking into drive-ins and as a kid, because there was one near our house, and they just ran like nothing but, you know, the Corman stuff and a lot of just regional pictures from all over the country. And a lot of times, like, you know, I was sneaking under a fence, so I'd be watching them without sound. Right. And so I'd have to make up the movies in my head, but then I'd see the trailers, and then later on I might catch the movie and be like, oh, that man, that was nothing like the trailer. You know, because you got like Joe Dante cutting the trailer for Corman.
Right.
And the trailer ends up being so much better. So, yeah, I was trying to do something like that, where it was like that 1973-ish era, but everything is, it just delivers everything. Right. And but still have it kind of cohesive. And then I used to watch a lot of art films, like Buñuel and Fellini. And so then I wanted to put a underlying theme in both those movies that might not be real apparent, but then people would be like, man, there's something more there, and they would keep coming back to revisit it. And those underlying themes are just like issues that I'm, you know, might be grappling with at the time, to give it just a little more. And I don't know whether it works or not.
Well, I'm on record in print on how much I love Frankenstein's Creative Bikers. I think that
very much. Like, that was a big production for me. Yeah. And trying to squeeze every, you know, nickel and stretch it as far as we could.
Oh, absolutely. And let's not forget that this is also, you know, relatively small budget film shot on 35mm. Which is nothing short of a miracle these days.
Yeah, that was the camera. I mean, you're talking 75 pounds of camera. So with the camera and the full mag and the lens. And there's hardly any handheld on that, because it was just too sadistic to the cinematographer.
Right. I mean, how was the stress level when you've got a film where you're doing, you know, predominantly practical effects, shooting on film? What was the stress level like on trying to make sure that shot got made?
Oh, it was pretty high. And, you know, it just, like, Super 16, which I had shot Dear God, No on, that just moves so much faster, because you got, you know, a magazine of film lasts twice as long. And so you're not changing, you know, magazines every 10 minutes, you know, worth of footage. And and the mobility of the camera. I mean, that was the biggest, you know, problem. But, you know, and it's different when you're shooting on film. Like, I know a lot of people that, you know, have never shot on film, primarily shoot digital, and they'll just like be burning, you know, their rehearsals. They'll just, you know, film them. Whereas when we go to do a take, because it's so expensive, and because you got to pay for the film, get it developed, get that transferred. And so, you know, it's a lot of money. So anyway, so what you do on set is you just rehearse like 3 or 4 times till everybody starts to click, and hope that nobody blows their lines or like, you know, a light bulb burst or something of that nature. And then, you just power through it. But it really slows you down, because, you know, there's like 4 people operating that camera.
Right.
On Super 16, you know, we had like 2 people, and one guy's constantly pulling focus and hitting different marks, you know, with every handheld shot. And here you've just got, oh, man. Yeah, it's a lot of work, a lot of people. And, I mean, there were days where just camera crew alone was like 8 guys.
Right. No, absolutely. And, I mean, and was it a little bit easier this time around, considering you brought back, you know, with a great tool of storytelling of bringing back the, you know, most of the cast from the first film, and being able to move through that way, at least having, you know, a certain relationship with everybody, kind of knew what they could do and what they couldn't.
Yeah, that helped, and I could play some of their strengths when I wrote the script. And then we had a lot more new characters, and I just wanted Frankenstein to be so friggin' over the top that, you know, and both films, I just, you know, I'm trying to make films that nobody has ever seen before. And and that I've
you succeeded. Seen. You succeeded in that.
Oh, thank you.
I actually, like I mentioned earlier, I only really truly liked one of these films, and yours was the one. So, I'm saying that because you're our guest. I said it's a nice thing that the if I'm only gonna like one of the films that we watch for podcast, that it's at least the one I'm their guest. But it wasn't intentionally so.
Oh, thank God! I had the knife to my wrist. I was just
yeah.
I was in suspense.
Oh man. Well, but I really did enjoy it quite a bit.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Justin.
Yeah, I'm not quite the aficionado of grindhouse cinema that the two of you are. I'm getting there. I'm working on it, but I'm not there. And that said, though, I don't know, moderate. I'm not a novice, but in that realm, I definitely saw quite a few nods and stuff, but yet it was still very fresh. It was very much its own thing. And I definitely, whenever I see a badass chick in it with an eye patch, I think of They Call Her One Eye. And that's always a good nod for me, because I think that movie is pretty damn great, even though the first time I saw it, I saw the X-rated version, and it had some really horrible graphic rape scenes in it. So that were added in, I found out after the fact. They weren't even part of the original footage. So, but nonetheless.
Yeah, I based her or Tristan Riss character off of her and Turo Satana from Faster Pussycat.
Okay.
And when Tristan showed up on set, she stayed in character whenever she was around me the whole time. And it was awesome.
Yeah, because at the premiere, she was still going at 100%.
Oh, yeah.
When I was talking to her, I don't think she broke character that whole night.
Yeah.
she was there.
But no, that was great. It was great because it was just so cool, like this thing I created, and it's just walking around talking to me all the time.
Right, just like, talking to everybody, you know, as Val. And I mean, you know, and speaking of Val, I love that, you know, with carrying over from Dear God No, you know, and I don't want to ruin the big shocking scenes, but I was so glad when they finally utilized that eye patch.
And yeah. Yes.
Took it to that degree. There, I love that carried over, you know, from, you know, the kind of the climax of Dear God No, which is one of my favorite. But now we'll...
That's the John Waters in me.
Right. There's a little Godard, a little John Waters throughout.
There's some Godard in both those films.
Absolutely. But
man, if it was a bigger pervert, I guess.
that is a good question to pose. Which one's the bigger pervert?
Oh, I'm probably Godard.
Yeah, but it's got to be Godard. It's got to be. Oh man. Well, Jimmy, it's been great. What's that?
It's Weekend.
Oh, I know.
Godard's Weekend?
Yeah, Weekend. That is one I had never seen that until probably about 2 years ago. And holy shit. Just in that opening 20 minutes, I was like, what the fuck? It was not the...
So what are we doing, an art film podcast now? Come on now. Yeah. No. I'm just fucking with you. I've never watched any Godard, so I'm out of the loop here.
See, and that's one thing I was telling Justin about you and kind of the conversations we've had. One thing I always enjoyed that when you were making these films, you're taking in a knowledge of just it doesn't feel like you're biting left and right from kind of the grindhouse wave of films that were coming out, where they were just basically kind of, you know, mimicking just this one, you know, one or two films, where you're a fan of film in general. You're someone that, yeah. You and I can chat about, you know, garbage pornos from the 80s, or, you know, talk about, you know, Truffaut or Godard. You have such an encompassing knowledge of film itself, and I think that really shows on screen that you're not just trying to parrot. You know what I mean? Especially with right. kind of that whole wave. I mean, and definitely, I think it helps turn a lot of people on to higher film that would usually just be, you know, just watching slasher flicks.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if I wanted to make a buck, I should probably make a vengeance movie or a slasher flick. But God, I think I'd be miserable making those.
No, absolutely. Cause, I mean, there hits a point unless you got some sort of, you know, paradigm shifting idea to it. I mean, low budget films, especially. I can only watch so many movies where you're just putting people in the woods. I mean, no knock to a lot of people that do it, because I know a lot of people cut their teeth that way. But
yeah,
we don't need another one. And I'm glad that you're out here doing something that's got a little more thought put into it and making something that doesn't exist before it. It pays homage without mimicking or parodying. But I
thank
can't
you very much. That's no, so nice to hear.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean,
that'll inspire me to make this next thing I'm working on.
Man, I hope it's what you and I talked about back a few months ago.
It is.
All right. and there's a lot of that is something that I'm excited about without saying anything, but. Jimmy, I cannot thank you enough for coming through and chatting with us and talking bikers.
Oh, thank you guys for having me. You know, I just love talking about film in general. I'm a big fan.
Yeah. this has been fantastic. And I mean, before we go, I mean, where can people follow you? You know, in your social medias and all that good stuff.
Oh, I'm on Twitter, but I don't understand it.
I've been tagging you and stuff. I was hoping you were noticing that. So.
But, I didn't catch it, Justin.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I said I was tagging you and stuff, and I said I hope you were noticing, because I noticed you didn't post a ton on there, so I was hoping, like, that you noticed that we were tagging you on the last few posts.
Well, I'll have to go look on Twitter and figure it out.
You'll have to do your monthly checkup on there.
Twitter's so bizarre. I got on there, and I was just, you know, posting random shit. And then one day I posted... Ingmar Bergman made over 57 films and not one car explosion. What an asshole. And all of a sudden, I had 50,000 followers. And I was like, what the fuck? I don't understand this.
I think you found the sweet spot on how to gain followers on social media.
Yeah, just make fun of Ingmar Bergman.
And I've been doing that for 30 years, and I haven't gotten any attention for it.
I used to do these screen grabs from Ingmar Bergman films, and it would be like somebody saying something just ridiculously existential. And then I was, some picture of, like, a lady, you know, going, my whole life's a lie.
Well, fantastic. And Jimmy, just let everybody know, where can they purchase Frankenstein Created Bikers? Hey, Jimmy, you still there?
Let's see.
Yeah, we lost
BigWorldPictures.us, Amazon, and gosh. Oh, what's the video? Grindhouse. They're online.
Yes, you can go to Big World Pictures or Amazon, or go to Grindhouse Video, and Diabolic got it as well.
Yeah. And Grindhouse. I know. I was looking to see who had it. So yeah, you can get it at all those sites, which is
or awesome. Grindhouse Video.
Yeah.
There you go.
So great. Well, man, I really appreciate it. We're all starting to break up at this point, so probably time to call it. But thank you again, man. It means a lot. Let's go grab some beers here soon. And
yeah, let's do. Can I plug one last thing?
Oh, absolutely.
Please do.
All right. So we have, I haven't announced this yet, but we have a M16 that was used by Tristan Risk as the stand-in M16. So it's a prop. It's not the real fully automatic M16 that she used when she was firing an M16. And we've had the entire cast sign this thing. And probably later this week, we're going to put it up on eBay for auction, and all the proceeds are going to go to Planned Parenthood.
Oh, fantastic. That's awesome. No, that's awesome. So everybody make sure to be keeping an eye out for that, and make sure so we can raise money for the ladies out there.
Yeah, we're going to give some back to the ladies so they can get, you know, free breast exams and stay healthy.
No, absolutely. Well, that's awesome. Well, thanks. We're going to be making sure to promote that as well, so everybody knows where that auction is and everything that's going on. So cannot thank you enough, man. Thank you for coming through. Like I said before, let's go grab some
thank
beers.
Thank you guys for just digging film and loving film and doing what you're doing and getting the word out there.
No, absolutely. Well, thank you again, man, and let's say goodnight.
All right. Good night, guys.
Good night, everybody. Hey, good peace.
Night. I saw a werewolf with a Chinese menu in his hand, walking through the streets of Soho in the rain. He was looking for the place called Lee Ho Fooks, gonna get a big dish of beef chow mein. Kitchen door. You better not let him in. Little old lady got mutilated late last night. Werewolves of London again. Gent who ran amok in Kent. Lately he's been overheard in Mayfair. You better stay away from him. He'll rip your lungs out, Jim. I'd like to meet his tailor.
Independent cinema. Man, we're going to have to edit the fuck out of that. But
I sit alone in my four-cornered room staring at candle. Oh, that shit is on? Let me drop some shit like this here. At night I can't sleep. I toss and turn. Candlesticks in the dark. Visions of bodies being burned. Four walls just staring at a nigga. I'm paranoid sleeping with my finger on the trigger. My mother's always stressing I ain't living right, but I ain't going out without a fight. See, every time my eyes close, I start sweating and blood starts coming out my nose. It's somebody watching the act, but I don't know who it is, so I'm watching my back. I can see him when I'm deep in the covers. When I awake, I don't see the motherfucker. He owns a black hat like I own, a black suit and a cane like my own. Some might say take a chill, B, but fuck that shit. There's a nigga trying to kill me. I'm popping in the clip when the wind blows. Every 20 seconds got me peeping out my window, investigating a joint for traps, taking my telephone for text. I'm staring at the woman on the corner. It's fucked up when your mind is playing tricks on you.
Wait, I've got an idea. What if, like, the next Marvel movie could take place on this plantation?
I'd be down with that.
I'm up
for
it.
I mean, like, we already got James Gunn in the Marvel universe. I'm sure we could get somebody else from, like, the Trump. Hey, James, you could do it.
No, nobody's giving me any money.
If they gave you that much, would you know what to do with it?
Yeah, I'll make a thousand movies.
Yeah.